came to the English throne in 1413. He was, wrote the Victorian historian William Stubbs, religious, pure in life, temperate, liberal, careful, and yet splendid, merciful, truthful, and honourable. Prudent, modest, magnanimous, a brilliant soldier, the founder of our military, international, and maritime law. A true Englishman, with all the greatness and none of the glaring faults of his Plantagenet ancestors. He was 25, and carried a certain reputation. We get some idea of it in a document called The Brut Chronicle. It refers to Henry's conversion to sobriety on his accession.
And in the same year that he was crowned at Westminster on the 9th day of April, he was a worthy king and a gracious man and a worthy conqueror.
Good. But before the 9th day of April.
And then he began to reign as king, and he remembered the great charge and worship that he should take upon him. And at once he commanded all his people who were parties to his misgovernance before that time, and all his household to come before him. And when they heard that, they were full glad, for they supposed that he would have promoted them into great offices, and that they would stand in great favour and trust with him, and be nearest of counsel as they were before that time. And trusting thereupon, they were the homelier and bolder unto him. Some of them winked at him, and some smiled, and thus they made foolish grimaces unto him, many of them. But for all that, the prince kept his countenance very serious towards them, and said to them, "Sirs, you are the people who I have cherished and maintained in full riot and wild governance, and here I give you my commandment, and charge you that from this day forward..."
Henry V had signed the royal pledge. He most certainly needed a clear head.
He came to the throne at a moment when England was wearied by feuds and brawl, and yearned for unity and fame. He led the nation away from internal discord to foreign conquest, and he had the dream, and perhaps the prospect, of leading all Western Europe into the high championship of a crusade. Council and Parliament alike suddenly showed themselves bent on war with France. The Commons were liberal with supply. The King, on his part, declared no law should be passed without their assent. A wave of reconciliation swept the land. The King declared a general pardon. He sought to assuage the past. He negotiated with the Scots for the release of Hotspur's son and reinstated him in the earldom of Northumberland. He brought the body, or the reputed body, of Richard II to London and reinterred it in Westminster Abbey with pageantry and solemn ceremonial. A plot formed against him on the eve of his setting out for the wars was suppressed, by all appearance with ease and national approval, and with only a handful of executions. In particular, he spared his cousin the young Edmund Mortimer, Earl of March, who had been named as the rival to the king, and through whose family much that was merciless was to follow later.
So we have Henry V in 1415 setting out for France with the blast of war blowing in his ears. The Churchillian, indeed the Orwellian idea that a foreign war is always good for morale at home, is about right. However, even in the medieval age, unity tends to be a consequence of war. And then only as long as you're winning, and as long as it doesn't cost too much in gold and lives. There are four other aspects of 15th century life which we should remember. First, combat is a central part of life. The tournament is applauded, especially its brutality. Then, England and France had been consistently, if not constantly, at war with each other since William the Conqueror. English kings had lucrative family possessions and titles in France, and were always fighting to maintain or increase them. Third, thanks to marriages of convenience, there was often an extant claim to the French throne itself. And fourth, the French had aligned and allied themselves with the Scots, and even with the Welsh. And so Henry claims his right to the throne of France. The French are weak from civil conflict between the Burgundians and the Orleanists. These are the royalists who offer him a large part of Aquitaine, 850,000 crowns, and Catherine, the daughter of King Charles VI. Henry plays along. In truth, he's negotiating with the Burgundians to let him enter France in safety, and promises that he will take their side against the Orleanists if they will support his claim to the throne.
The English army of about 10,000 fighting men sailed to France on August 11, 1415, and landed without opposition at the mouth of the Seine. Harfleur was besieged and taken by the middle of September. He now invited the Dauphin to end the war by single combat. The challenge was declined. The attrition of the siege and disease, which levied its unceasing toll on these medieval camps, had already wrought havoc in the English expedition. The main power of France was now in the field. The Council of War, on October the 5th, advised returning home by sea, but the king, leaving a garrison in Harfleur and sending home several thousand sick and wounded, resolved, with about 1,000 knights and men-at-arms and 4,000 archers, to traverse the French coast in a 100-mile march to his fortress at Calais, where his ships were to await him. All the circumstances of this decision show that his design was to tempt the enemy to battle.
When the two sides came face to face, it was at a field called Agincourt. The English saw the terrible odds. Remember, about 1,000 English knights and infantry and 4,000 archers. Facing them, perhaps 20,000 French cavalry and foot soldiers, a seemingly impenetrable wall of army, 30 men deep. One chronicler says there were eventually 60,000 French soldiers, but it would not have been possible to organise them all as a fighting force in a small area. Henry at one point tried to negotiate a withdrawal. He offered to give back Harfleur and the considerable numbers of French prisoners he'd taken. The French wanted one more concession. Henry would have to renounce his claim to the French throne. He refused. And so, on the feast of St. Crispinian and St. Crispin, the brotherly patron saints of shoemakers, Henry V led the advance to the French lines. To his right, his vanguard, commanded by the Duke of York. To his left, his rearguard, led by Lord Camoys.
The French were once again unduly crowded upon the field. They stood in three dense lines, and neither their crossbowmen nor their battery of cannon could be fired effectively. Under the arrow storm, they in turn moved forward down the slope, plodding heavily through a ploughed field, already trampled into a quagmire. Still at 30 deep, they felt sure of breaking the line. But once again, the longbow destroyed all before it. Horse and foot alike went down, a long heap of armoured dead and wounded, over which reinforcements struggled bravely, but in vain.
We have an eyewitness account of the battle. As ever, one pair of eyes cannot really see everything. Some of it must be hearsay, some forgotten and then wrongly reconstructed. But for the moment, this description, to be found in the deeds of Henry V, is so vivid and so spare that it must be close to the reality of that late afternoon of carnage at Agincourt.
The French nobles who had first approached our line divided themselves in three columns, attacked our forces at three places where there were banners. At their first clash, they met our men with such fierce impact that they were compelled to fall back for almost the distance of a lance. And then the battle grew hotter, and their archers shot. And when their arrows were exhausted, they seized axes, swords, and lances from those who were lying on the ground, and beat down, wounded, and killed the enemy with them. No one had time to receive them as captives. Almost all of them, without distinction of persons, when they fell to the ground, struck down by our men or by those following them, were killed without intermission. Such was the pressure of the host behind that the living fell on the dead, and others, falling on the living, were killed in turn. In three places, the piles of dead and those crushed in between grew so much that our men climbed on these heaps, which grew higher than a man, and slew those below with swords, axes, and other weapons. And when at last, after 2 or 3 hours, the vanguard was cut up and the rest were forced into flight, our men began to sort these heaps and separate the living from the dead, intending to keep the living as property to be ransomed.
Now occurred a terrible episode. The French third line, still intact, covered the entire front, and the English were no longer in regular array. At this moment, the French camp followers and peasantry, who had wandered round the English rear, broke pillaging into the camp and stole the king's crown, wardrobe, and great seal. The king, believing himself attacked from behind, issued the dread order to slaughter the prisoners. Then perished the flower of French nobility, many of whom had yielded themselves to easy hopes of ransom. The desperate character of this act supplies what defence can be found for its ferocity. The alarm in the rear was soon relieved, but not before the massacre was almost finished.
The troops of the enemy, having tasted the bitterness of our weapons, left the field of blood to us by God's will. Of the French there were, according to their own enumeration, more than 60,000 bearing sword. The number of our company of fighters did not exceed 6,000 men. Of this multitude there fell the dukes of Bar, Brabant, and Alençon, 5 counts, more than 90 barons and bannerets, more than 1,500 knights, and between 4,000 and 5,000 other gentlefolk.
The English lost perhaps 500. But the army was so weakened by the campaign that it struggled to reach the safety of Calais. By the following month, November, Henry returned to England. This was the hero the nation had wanted.
He took his journey by way of the sacred thresholds of the churches of Canterbury and of St. Augustine's Canterbury to his manor at Eltham, proposing to honour the city of London on the following Saturday. The citizens, hearing with the greatest joy the news of his approach, prepared themselves and the city. And when the desired day dawned, the citizens went out to meet the king at the brow of Blackheath. The mayor and 24 aldermen in scarlet, and the rest of the lesser citizens in red cloaks with red and white hoods, to the number of about 20,000 horsemen. And when the king came through the midst of them about 10 o'clock, and the citizens had given glory and honour to God, the citizens rode before the king towards the city, and the king followed.
Henry V now ruled a satisfied nation. But his own ambitions were not realised. For the next 2 years, he set out to overcome Normandy, not by spectacular battles, no more Crecy, Poitiers or Agincourt, but by siege and steady attrition. An agreement was reached. Henry would marry Catherine, the daughter of the mad Charles VI, and on his death, Henry would become King of France. That was in May 1420. Henry and Catherine married the following month. But by now, Henry was desperate for a conclusion to the war. He took just 1 day's honeymoon before he returned to the conflict. Exhausted and vulnerable to disease, 2 years later, he was dead. The hero, the wise and true Englishman, left a united England and a miserable France. Yet the cost of victory has to be paid long after the bells have finished chiming. And what could the new king, Henry VI, do? He was but 9 months old.